Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life is produced by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, a division of the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences. Visit us online at whyradioshow.org.
Hi, everybody. Jack Russell Weinstein here, host of Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. Gloria Steinem passed away yesterday. She was a tremendous figure for change, feminist advocacy and resistance, and intellectual exploration of the ways sex and gender permeate our lives, sometimes with tremendously unjust consequences. I had the tremendous honor of interviewing her for Why Radio almost 10 years ago, along with Ms. Magazine's editor Suzanne Braun Levine. I wanted to repost the episode to our feed, in part because I don't think my students even know who she is or what she accomplished. I believe it is imperative that we take the opportunity to reflect on what Gloria Steinem accomplished for all of us and what many feel is being undone as we speak. There are two things that I think are particularly notable about the episode. The first is that it took place right after the 2016 election and the tremendous women's march held in response. Gloria repeatedly expresses a powerful optimism that Trump's presidency will mark a new insistence on women's voices and inclusion. It's up to all of you, of course, to decide for yourself if this turns out to be true or even if it was necessary. The second is that at the end, my daughter Adina and her friend Faith took my place to interview our guests. They were 11-year-old middle schoolers who founded the Young Feminists of Grand Forks, a club that met weekly in the basement of our local women's shelter. I can't speak to what impact the experience had for either of them, but I'm beyond grateful to have had the good fortune to make it possible. So please take the opportunity to consider Gloria Steinem and feminism philosophically, as well as the intersection of the older and younger generations of women and the role that feminism plays in all of their lives. Thanks for listening, and as always, it's an honor to be with you. Hi. Welcome to Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. Today marks our 100th episode, a milestone exactly 8 years in the making. And to celebrate, we're joined by Gloria Steinem and Suzanne Braun Levine, who are here to talk with us about feminism as philosophy, politics, and friendship. I can think of few guests more suitable for the 100th episode of Why Radio than Gloria Steinem and Suzanne Braun Levine. They and their feminist cohorts emphasized that everyday sexism was built on ideology as much as habit, creating a space for philosophy in the public consciousness. Gloria and Suzanne's creation, Ms. Magazine, prepared the ground for blogs, college courses, and television shows we have today. It was critical thinking. It was public philosophy. Ms. offered a counterpoint to the notion that women were only interested in, well, notions. Its title alone was transgressive. It recognized that the most personal designation, that term by which we are acknowledged by others, announced our limitations. Women called Miss were deemed perpetually immature, and those referred to as Mrs. were relegated to the background of a couple. Those called Ms., however, were protected by ambiguity, freed from the conviction that without a husband they were nothing. They could pursue the life of their choice, in theory anyway. Ms. marked a profound challenge to our philosophical tradition. The ancient Greek philosophers took for granted that social life consisted of two spheres, the polis, the political life of the city governed by men, and the oikos, the household domain of women. Plato tried to change this, arguing that men and women were equal, but he had to eradicate the family to do it. There were only politics, no households, in his republic. Aristophanes also pushed back. His play Lysistrata tells the story of women who go on sex strikes to stop men from fighting wars. It had many examples of intellectually and physically powerful women, but it was still a farce. It had its audience laugh at women, not with them, and it was performed entirely by men. Women were forbidden from acting in the Greek theater. 2,500 years and only a handful of feminist philosophers later, the presumption that politics was for men still dominated. John Rawls's A Theory of Justice, the most important political theory of the late 20th century, came out the same year as the first Ms. magazine. It argued that the rules of a just society were separate from family relations, assuming in the process that families were built on love and goodwill. They were not political units for Rawls. He never acknowledged the domestic abuse, the favoritism, and the hatred that so often permeated familial life. He also ignored the feminist insight that politics defined what we would call a family in the first place. The term Ms. challenged all of this. It told us that the personal was political and demanded that women be welcome as equal in all aspects of life, however we choose to organize it. I will admit that I'm too young to fully recognize the transgressive nature of the title Ms. itself. I grew up taking its legitimacy for granted. I can also easily forget how challenging feminism itself can still be. But as the most recent election highlighted, there are plenty of people who still don't believe that women have a right to lead. Whoever you voted for, you must acknowledge that Hillary's opponents never called her Ms. Clinton. They always called her Mrs. The term Ms. does something else, though. It leaves room for more than just marital relationships. It acknowledges that women have other people in their lives, private and public associates of comparable stature, who are all individuals themselves. It acts as a bulwark against those who demand to know who a woman associates with. Colleague, lover, acquaintance, even enemy, the term Ms. lets a woman decide for herself how much she wants to explain. It acknowledges that women, in fact, have friends of their own choosing and that who they choose to spend their time with is their own business. Our guests, Gloria Steinem and Suzanne Braun-Levine, are the model of a feminist friendship. Gloria co-founded Ms., and Suzanne was its first editor, and they continue to write, fight, and demand equality together since its inception. Aristotle, another Greek philosopher and no champion of women, argued that friendship, not citizenship, ought to be thought of as the primary social relationships. Many feminists agree. Why radio could not have existed without Suzanne and Gloria's work. I work very hard to treat my listeners and guests as equals, as co-investigators into all things philosophical. Feminism introduced the idea that a host could be on equal par with the audience and still respect them. No, I said that wrong. Feminism insisted on the idea that unless a host was on equal par, the audience wasn't being respected at all. I accept this notion without qualification, and our 100th episode is all the more celebratory because two of the women who taught it to me are here to teach me more. And now our guests. Gloria Steinem and Suzanne Braun-Levine are writers, activists, and feminist icons. They've written many books and articles between them and left an indelible mark on American political life and pop culture. Gloria, Suzanne, thank you so much for joining us on this particularly important episode of Why.
Well, congratulations.
I think we've both learned a lot from your introduction.
I hadn't
thought about the whole idea of Ms. allowing individual relationships as well as doing away with being identified by a marital one. Thank you for that introduction.
Very informative. Well, I appreciate that. I think the idea of all of this is that it still has power and that the word Ms. can still surprise all of us, right? That it's a force for not just political change, but intellectual insight every time you say it, because it introduces the idea that this person, this Ms., is herself worthy of consideration, worthy of curiosity, worthy of intellectual focus. And I think you all knew that, even if you weren't necessarily saying it explicitly. But that's just, my guess. I wasn't there. I do want to say to the audience that we are pre-recording the show, so we won't be taking any questions. But if you'd like to send your comments, visit us on Twitter at Why Radio Show or on Facebook at facebook.com Why Radio Show, or visit us live in our chat room at whyradioshow.org. So I have to say, interviewing the two of you is a fairly daunting task. You've both been interviewed a lot. You've been asked a lot of questions. And I wasn't quite sure where to start, but I guess I want to focus in on what this show is really aimed at. So what I'm really curious about is, with all of the time you've both had in front of crowds, in front of cameras, how often do you have the chance to talk philosophically about your work, about the ideas themselves and the intellectual aspects of feminism as distinct from the activism?
I think that we have probably more opportunity than most folks because what we are saying is still, although now supported by the majority in terms of simple equality in all the different areas of life, it's still relatively new in terms of philosophy. So, for instance, Ms. Is still important for all the reasons you state. But in a way, the world is divided into two kinds of people, those who divide everything into two and those who don't. And now we've moved beyond gender. Gender, which was made up just as race was made up. So I think that, you know, to be part of any social justice movement is probably to be on the forefront of philosophy.
Did it take you a long time to figure out that gender was a fiction? Or was it something that you had as an insight that you maybe didn't know how to articulate at first?
Well, I think I always understood. I mean, if you look at the human qualities as a circle, which is the way they're presented in psychology texts, you know, it turns out that about a third are feminine and two thirds are masculine. So it was always clear to me that the division was unjust. But actually, it's also clear that men have all the qualities thought of as feminine: attention to detail, nurturing, patience, because they're just the qualities that you need to raise children, and so they're called feminine. And women also have the assertiveness and daring and whatever it is that's called masculine. So in that sense, I was always pretty clear that we all had all of those qualities, and that progress for men and women might lie in the opposite direction, but each of us was trying to complete the circle.
You know, Ms. Magazine had as its primary audience women. Was the magazine structure, was the idea and the process itself different because it had such explicitly feminist themes, or was it just a magazine that was about this other stuff?
No, I think it was it made its historic contribution just because not only was it about women as full people, as you said, but also that it was run by women. I think there were, at that time, you know, all the women's magazines were edited by men. And the notion that a group of women could produce a first-rate magazine was by itself revolutionary. And I don't think we could have touched as many people if the material we were putting in the magazine wasn't coming from our own life experience. You know, this notion that the personal is political is really connected to the idea that everyone has a story. And basically what we were always trying to do was to tell the stories of women's lives. And when those stories exposed situations that were intolerable, then the political activism became part of the story. But I do think that the fact that it was published by women, that we had editorial meetings where we went from talking about electoral politics to talking about menstrual cramps, that we had, there was a very special voice behind the magazine.
I'm curious about that voice, Suzanne. I'm curious about being the editor in charge of, you know, presenting that voice and tweaking that voice. As an editor, did you have a sense that language was either male or female, and did you want to bring that stuff out, or was the editing recognizable in pretty much every way to all editors as the same craft? Was the language and the edits and the things that you were trying to do, were they themselves feminist projects?
Well, I didn't think of the language as gendered. But I did think of our obligation as gendered. Editing is very strange because people think that editors just take things apart and make them better. But what we had to do was really highlight the voice of the person who was writing and try to bring out the message of that particular story. So there were often stories that we ran that kind of threw me. There were topics that I wasn't comfortable with. And yet I was comfortable, I think we all were comfortable, with the idea of challenging people to think about experiences other than their own and to think about experiences in a different way.
So stepping back to before Ms., before this period in your life, both of you, Gloria and Suzanne, do you remember as kids when you had permission to challenge people beyond, say, your immediate parents? At what point did you discover that either you weren't allowed to have a voice or that as girls you had to assert your voice in a particular way because lots of people wouldn't give you permission? Or am I just projecting the history books on it and you both didn't have that experience at all, right? I don't want to define the answer for you. But at what point did you discover your own voices as young women and as girls?
Well, I arrived in a gendered world, which meant that in my case, I read Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys and, you know, tried to encompass everything. But Louisa May Alcott in my childhood became my voice. She was, of course, a great feminist and socially conscious person of her era. And, you know, I guess I found writers who were speaking as if as I might speak, and I fell in love with them. And books were my total refuge and, you know, place to have wings of imagination. I mean, you know, I my idea of reading a book was that I started it and I finished it, regardless of how long I had to stay up and go without sleep. And that was very helpful. But there was no place for the idea that aside from a few voices like Louisa May Alcott, that there was some way of healing this wound between Dick and Jane in our primers in school.
Well, my experience, Gloria was way ahead of me. I was a tomboy, and as those two words suggest, that meant that I was on the wrong track. And I felt very alienated because I really wanted to be strong and athletic, and I really didn't want to wear skirts. And at that time, that was really revolutionary. And I once was invited to give a speech in front of the whole school, but they told me I had to wear a skirt, so I turned it down. So I was always very aware of the restrictions on being a girl and a woman. So that when Title IX came along, I just felt that the world had been saved for girls like me. And we've seen that this amazing emergence of strong, competitive women that I couldn't have imagined when I was playing half-court basketball and not allowed to play if you had your period. So for me, it was sports, I think, that both made me feel different and finally made me feel that girls like me were included.
You know, it's really intriguing to think about both the sports connection and the dress connection, because things have gone fairly full circle, or maybe that's the wrong way of phrasing it. But there's an irony that a lot of high school students, a lot of young women complain that if they wear certain clothes, they're sent home because they're called distractions. They can't show their bra strap, or they have to wear bras when they go to school. They can't wear too short skirts. They can't wear leggings. And so the sense that they have to dress in a way that they're not noticed is pressured. And yet at the same time, as you point out, we have these tremendous athletes, these women who are doing superhuman things. And yet at the same time, they're expected to – pose naked for the body issue of Sports Illustrated and Esquire and use their sexuality to gain sponsorships to sponsor their professional careers. How do you make sense of the pop culture pressures that both celebrate the achievements that you had and yet at the same time sexualizes them and takes away their power as achievements as opposed to as the result of just bodies?
Well, I think you've just said it in a way, because the hypersexualization of girls younger and younger is part of the backlash against the strength and equality and humanity that has also gone forward. So you get the same things at the same time. One is going forward and the other is a backlash against it. You know, this doesn't happen in men's sports. I think the fact that it happens in women's sports is specifically that the culture feels challenged by sports, which are so important because they are the place where, I mean, I think Suzanne was ahead of me. I was not into sports. I was into tap dancing my way out of Toledo in probably a very stereotyped way. But sports are the place where women are most likely to learn that our bodies are instruments, not ornaments. And so the drive to turn us back into ornaments becomes doubly strong. It's a backlash.
I mean, I've really noticed amongst my college students and the high school students that I know that the young women who are athletes carry themselves in the world differently. They have a better sense of their body, and yet it doesn't seem like it's enough. So how do you fight that? How do you reward attention to one's physical self without creating not just unrealistic beauty standards, but without creating vulnerabilities that make these athletes want to hide their bodies as opposed to celebrate them and achieve the excellence that sports is supposed to bring out?
Well, they're kind of antithetical, aren't they? I mean, you can't run in high heels and you can't sweat in makeup. So I think the girls and women who have the experience of athletics are way more likely to be in touch with who they really are, feel comfortable when they get up in the morning without having put on mascara to go to the corner drugstore. You know, it just seems to me to be altogether very healthy. But the backlash is with us too, and this happens in everything. I mean, it's in the election. You know, the very fact that we have an anti-equality, biased president at this moment in time is because he represents a minority but very well-financed and powerful backlash against all the social justice movements that now have the majority in public opinion polls. So, you know, to go forward is to make people who, through no fault of theirs, got born into a society in which they felt they had a certain spot on the hierarchy because of their race, because of their gender, their class, whatever it is, they are now in backlash. And nowhere is it written that the backlash won't win, but it is important to celebrate the fact that everything you and I are talking about, all the issues, the generalized issues of human equality, now have majority support in public opinion polls.
You know, that's it's such an important and often forgotten insight for those of us who are so focused on the social justice stuff that, yes, it does have minority support, right? Hillary Clinton did win the popular vote, and that tells us something. Yet it also tells us, right, Trump used, right, women's bodies as weapons and our culture ignored it, right? He sexually assaulted people. He judged people. He did all of these things, and it was almost entertainment for the audience. And so he starts with the body and then makes people feel worthless because of the bodies that he attacks. So
but wait a minute, though. Okay. You're giving him the – you say people – it's not the majority – You know, we just had the biggest march in the history of marches worldwide, pretty spontaneously, contagiously, because it's against that. And he did not win the popular vote. He lost by 10 million people voted for somebody other than him. Both things happen at the same time, change and backlash against change.
When we come back, I want to follow up on this notion of things happening at the same time. And I also want to talk about friendships and personal relationships and how this gives strength to individuals and the movements. And I'm very interested also in just following the intellectual development of as how the ideas of equality and independence and self-reliance changed as the two of you progressed both in your professions and as you got older. For the moment, you are listening to Gloria Steinem and Suzanne Braun-Levine and Jack Russell Weinstein on Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We'll be back right after this.
The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. Visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
You're back with Jack Russell Weinstein. I'm talking with Gloria Steinem and Suzanne Braun-Levine about feminism, politics, philosophy, and friendship. And I want to switch the conversation just a little bit to the relationships that you developed during Ms. Magazine and later on. Gloria, Suzanne, how important were the two of you to each other in terms of developing ideas, debating, and setting a model for yourself as to what to aspire? I mean, what's the theoretical place of friendship in what it means to be a feminist and what it means to be an activist?
I think one of the things that the feminist movement focused on was the importance of women's friendships. When I look at my mother's life, she thought that every woman was a competitor after her man, that she couldn't trust any other women. And when we started working together, I still was aware of that mindset. So that part of the experience of Ms. was developing that trust and understanding that women help each other. There's some interesting studies that show that women, when you have a cup of coffee with your girlfriends and people say you're wasting your time, not true. Women in groups release oxytocin, which is one of the more important love hormones. And it makes it possible to develop your best skills because you're helping each other, you're reinforcing each other, you are reassuring each other. And people even think that one reason women live longer than men is because these doses of oxytocin bring down the stress that men live with all the time. So I think this oxytocin-filled experience of being in an office with people who were like you, who you trusted, who cared as much about the project as you did, was unique. And I think it changed all of us. It certainly changed me.
Yes, that's definitely true. And it's probably also important to say that men experience the oxytocin response. I mean, when you put a baby in the arms of anyone, male or female, they're flooded with oxytocin because it is the tendon befriend hormone. It is what allows us to empathize with each other. Or when you see someone in an accident in the street and you feel you must help them even though you don't know them, that's a response to oxytocin without which the human race could not possibly have survived. So it isn't as if it's exclusive to women, but it is culturally balanced or pushed toward women, because once we're free of the idea, as Suzanne points out, that we are competing with each other, then we see the motivation in shared experience and community and helping each other. This can happen to men too, but I think it's more difficult because culture wrongly gives them the idea that they are supposed to compete even more than it gives to women.
I want to pull this thread a little bit, in part because we have a listener question. Joyce from New York talks about how many women don't like to talk about it, that it's kind of off limit, but that jealousy is a real problem in women friendship. How do you deal with that? And in the back of my mind also is this notion, especially for the younger generation, this word frenemy, that you have a friend who is a competitor, they're friends to your face, but they undermine you. There's no male equivalent to frenemy. It is a gendered female word. So to what extent is – I'm not even sure what question I'm asking other than to say I'd like to hear more about how the two of you both maintained the friendship and other friendships in the face of all the stress, and why it continues to – why people continue to denigrate and break apart female friendships, even to the extent that there is this exclusive word that makes young women think that it's both normal and healthy to have friends who undermine them and belittle them.
Well, I didn't know that frenemy was gender specific. Maybe it is. But certainly men compete with each other in terms of money, in terms of sports, in terms of attractiveness to women and so on. But I think men are allowed to be or expected to be more individual, where women are more interchangeable. And to the extent that we're treated as interchangeable, then we're more likely to envy interchangeable qualities in each other, how we look, how we dress, male approval, and so on. But I personally have not experienced that. I mean, my women friends are my chosen family, some men too, but old lovers are definitely very important family members. But, I just think that envy comes out of a society, is due to a society that doesn't treat you as unique individuals. And as soon as it treats men or women as if they have interchangeable qualities, then you increase the opportunity for envy.
I'm thinking about the structures that lead to this, and I'm thinking about an experience I had that I'm reluctant to say out loud because I know my daughter is listening to the show. But when she was born, the number of people who came up to me and said, "Oh, you had a girl. Are you disappointed?" was shocking. Right? We know that men really want sons. Are you unhappy that you had a girl? And first of all, I wanted a girl. And second, there's no circumstance in the universe in which my daughter Adina is a compromise, right? She's the best thing that ever happened to me. But from birth, I mean, I guess from pre-birth, this interchangeability that comes and the sense of woman as compromise that comes so early on,
And it's reinforced in terrible ways in some cultures, because if women have daughters and no sons, even though this sex is more likely to be determined by the father than by the mother, I think, status of the woman diminishes, and she may even be abandoned as a wife. So the whole focus on having sons has caused a gender, a sex imbalance in much of Asia, for instance, because boys are so much more valuable than girls that there is a female infanticide, and now there is a gender imbalance in many parts of Asia. So it, you know, it can come to be very extreme and very suicidal. But I think actually what happens is we have baby humans, and maybe if we respond in that way, what did you have? I had a baby human.
That's a great idea.
But the other side of it is that it's become very clear that the best way to introduce a man to feminism is for him to have a daughter, because the idea that his precious daughter should be restricted or excluded makes him crazy. And suddenly they get it. Suddenly they get it. And I'm sure you were a feminist before Adina was born, but I'm sure you're more aware of the limitations that are still there to girls' opportunities.
The other side of the coin is also true, I think, because I think women now as mothers are much more likely to be aware of maintaining their relationship with their sons. The old Freudian paradigm would say, you know, you're supposed to kind of push your son away so that he can become masculine in the proper patriarchal sense. And, you know, he's not supposed to cry, he's not supposed to show emotion and so on. But what happens when women as mothers obey that is that they push their sons away from the person they've probably been the closest to, and the sons feel betrayed and may never trust another woman again. Now, I think mothers are much more likely to stay connected to their sons as to their daughters.
I think, I mean, that makes sense to me. At the same time, I see in my students, particularly the women's, well, no, I guess both, this reluctance to both acknowledge the benefits that they've had from feminism and to even consider themselves a feminist. We had a question from Cindy from Washington, who asked, how do we convince 20-somethings that we're not living in a post-feminist age, or an age when feminism is no longer necessary? These are both men and women who grew up with the benefits of feminism, and yet they find the idea and the label threatening. How do you address the idea of feminism to, for lack of a better phrase, people who should know better?
I think all that changed on November 8th. Hmm. I think what we saw at the march and the marches around the world were women, exactly the women you're speaking about, who woke up to what the threats were, that they, things that they'd been taking for granted, things that had enabled them to focus on their own lives and make the most of their own lives. Suddenly, they were really, it was a wake-up call that everything that we had taken for granted was threatened. And I think you're going to see that the new movement that's emerging in reaction to that is going to include a whole lot of women who may have even said, I'm not a feminist, but who now I predict will be happy to call themselves feminist.
I think Suzanne is exactly right. No one since the election has said to me that we are in a post-racist or post-feminist age. Not one single human being has said that. So, you know, it is a profound recognition. But I also think we are at fault, maybe, are generationally speaking folks who expect gratitude, because the truth is that gratitude never radicalized anybody. I did not walk around saying thank you for the vote. I got mad based on what unfairness was happening to me. And I don't think that we should expect young women or young men who are born into this culture to, or at least that's what's, it only happens secondarily. First, you get mad at what happens to you. And then you realize that you can learn something and you're grateful to the people who fought the battles before. But first comes the recognition of what's happening in the present.
You said something in passing, both, that I think is really instructive, that gratitude never radicalized anyone. But implicit in that is this notion that being radicalized is good, that being a radical is good. This notion, which was at least widely believed, if not the majority belief, in the 1960s and 70s, has fallen to the wayside, particularly in the light of religious fanaticism. What's the argument for the goodness of radicalism?
I think the dictionary is the argument for it, because if you look at the root of the word, it just means going to the root. It doesn't mean violence. It doesn't mean any particular action. It just means looking for the source of something. And to the extent that the whole beginning of every hierarchy is controlling reproduction and therefore controlling wombs and controlling the bodies of women, it is the root of hierarchy, and it is redoubled when there is any kind of racism or caste system, as in India, because in order to continue that racial separateness or caste separateness, you have to doubly control the bodies of women. So there's no such thing as a racist system or a caste system that isn't also anti-feminist and anti-equality. And once you see that intertwining, and once you see the real meaning of the word, radical, then I think it becomes a kind of joyous accuracy. It's just wrongly sometimes perceived as being violent.
I want to push this, though, because here in North Dakota in particular, very at least vocally red state, the culture here is one of tremendous conformity. That we experience here what gets called tall poppy syndrome. And it's the idea that the poppies have to be exactly the same size, because if they're taller than the others, they fall over and they die. And this cultural expectation to be quiet, to be like everyone else, to dress like everyone else and see everyone else. I see this even in the classroom, where students are reluctant to raise their hand. So how do you convince people who want to conform that radicalism, even if it just means making your voice heard at the root of things, is something to be desired? How do you convince people that being the center of attention, even if just momentarily, is both good and important?
I think what Suzanne said in the first instance about telling stories is the way. You know, everybody has a story of their life and experience and what happened yesterday and what matters to them. And if you create a circle in which each person can speak in turn and tell their own story, and each person gets to talk as much as they listen and listen as much as they talk, you begin to see the profound sense of belonging and support that we desperately need in order to survive and thrive. I mean, each one of us is a unique miracle that could never have happened before or again. And each one of us is also a human being. That means we share 99% of everything. And our brains are organized on narrative. I think encouraging people to tell their stories is the way forward.
There's also this, and I'm particularly curious about Suzanne's take on this strand in feminism of not only just self-empowerment, but self-realization that gets filtered and has its tentacles in self-help books, and then I said fatty books like Eat, Pray, Love. To what extent is this self-realization and this self-focus a necessary part of the process of feminist empowerment, feminist realization, and political change?
Well, I've written a lot about the wonderful experience of being a woman over 50, because there is a liberation in being, you know, it's the upside to the downside in being less relevant, in being less courted. We find ourselves able to figure out who we are. It's not easy because we got as far as we've gotten playing by a lot of rules that are still there. And for me, the big turning point is two things. One is learning to say no, which as a well-bred woman or girl is something that you shouldn't do. Your purpose in life is to see what people want you to do and then do it. And the other is, and every woman that I have talked to who's reached this age says, you know, I don't care what people think anymore. And that realization is the beginning of getting to know who you are. And it should have happened earlier. And it does happen earlier for many women. But the whole process of rejecting the expectations and the reward that comes from that of feeling authentic and feeling free is an experience that I hope more women find it as they grow older. Now, I'm hoping this will happen with younger women sooner. But as I watch women get older, I am encouraged by the energy that's released and the self-awareness.
This notion of authenticity rings or echoes this longstanding debate about what is often called false consciousness, that these folks who think that they are one thing or think that they're helping themselves are actually working against their own advantage. I think it was Andrea Dworkin wrote a book called A Right Wing that's hard to say, Right Wing Women. and about this notion of false consciousness. Can someone be falsely authentic? Can someone think they are one thing and just not know enough to know that they're hurting themselves? I mean, does everyone get to decide their own authenticity, or is there sort of an objective reality as to who and what somebody can and should be?
You know, I think there's a balance between internal and external. And when, you know, the piece that Andrea Dworkin wrote, which was originally for Ms. Magazine that you describe about right-wing women, and I pled with her to turn it into a book because it was such a brilliant commentary on why women became parts of religion and right-wing groups that actually were working against them. She made very clear that they were responding to promises of safety, of love, of sustenance that, you know, were very tempting promises, in return for which you gave up your individuality and free will. So, you know, that's essentially what she was saying in a genius way, which explains why it is so tempting if you feel threatened, if you feel you can't make a living on your own, if you feel you need an absolute answer to very uncertain areas of your life, that it's like cults or authoritarianism or patriarchy itself, or, you know, it's very, very seductive. But what it means is you give up your internal uniqueness and voice in order to say yes to something that is a group discipline. So by definition, you're giving up your authenticity, that is your internal uniqueness, or diminishing it at least.
So authenticity for you is more about one's individuality and free will and uniqueness and not necessarily about finding one's true self?
Well, isn't one's true self internal and unique? I mean, we each are combinations of heredity and environment combined over millennia upon millennia in us in a way that could never happen again and could never have happened before. So that is our unique voice in balance, not instead of, but in balance with the fact that we experience shared humanity and we, in fact, are part of all of nature. But if it's all external and the influence is all external, then we're out of balance.
So much of what you've both been saying just comes back to this notion that we have to find both this balance, that things are happening simultaneously, the positive and the negative, that there's just these external and internal forces. At what point does feminism need, or does it need, a sense of spirituality? Is there some soul-focused, for lack of a better term, thread of feminism that has a global, not just a global view, a universal view, a spiritual view, a larger than day-to-day life view, the thing that religions provide for so many people? Does feminism have something like that, and is that a necessary component?
Of course. I mean, I think religion, spirituality, all of those words are words for things we don't know. But we sense that we are part of a universe. We sense that we are shared in our humanity, that nature, I mean, I think actually the word pagan, if it had not been so done in by monotheism, is a truly great word because it just means nature. It means that we are all part of nature. I had to go to have a hospital exam a couple of years ago, and even though it was minor, you have to fill in religion, you know, just in case you drop dead while you're in the hospital. So I put down pagan, and the nurse said to me, "What does that mean?" I said, "It just means I think we're all part of nature." I converted her on the spot. Now, religion is a different story frequently because it is an institution, and it tells us that God is more present in men than in women, or in some races than other races. It establishes a hierarchy. So I think religion and spirituality are not always the same thing.
We had a few questions that brought in this question of race the question of white feminists talking to black feminists, and I'm trying to find Catherine in Massachusetts asked this. They all ask in the form of advice, what can white feminists do, that sort of thing. I want to ask that. I want to ask them advice in a little bit. But I want to ask first gender, race, class, right? Angela Davis, the whole notion of the overlap of women's interests and civil rights and gay rights. How has the feminist movement struggled with the accusation, especially in the 1960s and 70s, that it was what we would now call a movement of white privilege? How has the feminist movement changed, or how has it rethought what it meant by inclusion and diversity? And has the new notions of what diversity means, including things like transgender folks, has that affected the way that you think about both the ideas and the message that you impart to others?
You know, in one of the early issues of Ms. Magazine, we did a Lewis Harris poll, a national, I think maybe the first poll on the women's movement and feminist issues. And as a result of that poll, you could see that African-American women were supportive of the movement and the issues by 60-some percent, and white women by only 30-some percent. So it has always been true, as in the results of this election, that black women have been way more likely to be supporting the issues of equality and feminism and the women's movement than white women. And I think the reporting of the women's movement as white, I'm sure that white women are more likely to get their books published. And so, you know, right. Maybe that was part of the reason that the movement seemed more white. But it's never, ever been true. It certainly isn't true in my life. Disproportionately, I learned feminism from black women. And it is the racism that is everywhere, of course, including in the women's movement, but especially in the perception of movements, so that people did not see that the civil rights movement was at least half women, and the Martin Luther King march where I was, as a black woman standing next to me, who was extremely angry, pointed out there were no black women speaking. And that was perceived as a male movement, and the feminist movement is perceived as a white movement, and neither one is accurate.
You know, that's an important insight, and I never really thought about that. Have you gotten better as you've become more practiced in managing the media narrative? Is there a way for you, for Suzanne, and for activists in general to push for a more accurate portrayal of what's happening, or are you still, or are we all still, at the mercy of whatever story the newspaper, the magazine, the television show wants to tell?
Well, you can start your own media, which is what Ms. Magazine was and is still, and thanks to Suzanne's editorship, was always very inclusive and diverse and interesting and surprising. And that is still going on. And then the second way is to influence the media that already exist. We probably should have had a women's media movement in the way that we had a women's health movement way earlier than we did. But there is a women's media movement now. The Women's Media Center, for instance, you can find their website online, and there are stories and experts in every area and ratings of the media for their inclusiveness or lack of it. I think this election also has proved to us how important facts are, how sacred facts are. So I believe that will help us to make the media more accurate.
The other thing is this notion of the movement and its agenda suggests that somewhere, you know, there are the tablets that are required learning for every feminist. And what's happening now, it seems to me, is that it's become more and more organic, and that the issues that are emerging now are emerging among people who have something to say. They are not emerging from leaders. The whole controversy about the march and whether it was inclusive and whether it was white women or young women or old women, I think it's healthy if we can stay organic and kind of go with the flow as each interest becomes better able to articulate its concerns. The idea of one leader at this point, I think, is not reflective of where we are as a diverse group that is trying to sort things out.
You talk about leadership, you talk about diversity. This leads to one of the two remaining questions I have, and then we're going to try something a little different. But has your notion of what equality is changed over time, or would you consider equality and the goals that you strive for now to be pretty much what you thought of when you started?
You know, speaking for myself, what has changed my idea of equality and raised my hopes for it is learning more about what was here on this subcontinent before Europeans showed up. And if we didn't just start our learning with Plato, who really wasn't too swift and quite biased, if we started with original cultures, the Kwe and the San in Africa, the Dalits in India, and the Native Americans here, we would find cultures in which the paradigm was a circle, not a pyramid, in which there was no gender in many of the languages. There was not even he and she, not even pronouns, in which there was the ideal was balance, not imbalance, not hierarchy. And that was the way life was lived. So maybe if the folks in your state look at the people who originally lived there, they would find a great source of hope.
I think there are a lot of people who are making that argument, and it's a hard argument to make, not in the sense that it's a hard argument to justify, but as the two of you know better than almost anybody, getting through those biases, getting through those resistances is amongst the hardest thing that someone can do. And I want to ask one last question, and it comes directly from what you were just saying. We had a question from Susan Henking. She's the president of Scheimer College, which is this very small liberal arts college that's located on the campus of a different college. And she wanted to know what philosophical text you would recommend for today's feminists. And I guess I want to expand the question a little bit. What books were both – do you think would still be influential or that are necessary reading or are a good stepping stone for people who are really striving to figure out their place in the world, their place in the movement, and what it means to be an activist? What would you recommend – our listenership, they are readers. So what kind of books would you recommend? And specifically, are there any philosophy texts that you think are particularly useful?
You know, that's such a big question. I mean, I would love to
make lists. It's an unfair question,
list,
frankly.
But I mean, all of Bell Hooks, all of Andrea Dworkin, all of Robin Morgan, they're just all of Suzanne Levine's, turning this into day-to-day practicality in her books. There are so many, and we each find one that is our way in, because of our narrative. But I think the biggest drawback, the biggest problem is that we don't study people when people began. We study people when patriarchy and monotheism began, and therefore we come to think that it's human nature and there's no way out. So if we could just begin literally with what is, what was and often still is on the ground under our feet or near us, instead of, I have a book called The History of History, which I think is such a giveaway, At the opening lecture of the Museum of the American Indian in Washington, there's a guy saying there are two things, the past and history, and they are not the same. And if we just realize the politics of history, we would begin to realize what we've been missing.
Okay, I lied because I have one more question. I do this all the time. So given what you're learning about history, and I think part of the point that you're trying to make, as I understand it, is that anthropology, particularly ancient anthropology, needs to be more of a focus. But given what you just said about history, do you feel confident, each of you, that you can tell your own story in a way that's representative of the conflicts and the uncertainties and the growth and the change? Or do you think that as people who lived it, those histories are going to be as distorted as any other history simply because I don't know that we can ever be objective about our own subjectivity? Can you tell your own stories? I mean,
question. You're a lot more likely to be close to the truth if you tell your own story than if you footnote. If you footnote, you may be in big trouble because you're getting into generalities rather than particularities of a story. So if we, to the extent that we can share our stories and just follow simple common sense rules, for instance, if you're in a group where you have more power than other folks, you might be sure to listen as much as you talk. If you have less power, you might be sure to talk as much as you listen, which can be even more difficult because you're used to hiding. So, you know, if you just follow rules of kind of balance as you go into whatever the enterprise is, the means are the ends. If you use balanced and equal means, you'll get to those ends.
I want to change tack a little bit. We're going to do something experimental here. We've never done this before. I've brought in two other guests on my end of the studio. My daughter Adina, who's 11, and our long-term listeners are probably already tired of me talking about her, and her friend Faith, also 11. And they very much wanted to ask you questions and to talk to both of you. And I really thought that it was important not only to have other voices, but young female voices to address you because for all of the obvious reasons. So Adina, Faith, welcome to Y Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
They're both a little nervous. This is their first time on something like this. Adina, can you tell me, what gave us the idea to have you talk here? What's been going on that made you want to ask these kinds of questions of Gloria and Suzanne?
Well, Faith and I both were really upset when Hillary Clinton lost the presidential election, and that was kind of our turning point where we decided that we had to make a change. So we started the Young Feminists of Grand Forks, and it gave us the opportunity to be on here and talk to these two amazing, influential people.
and the Young Feminists of Grand Forks is a club and has ranged from 6 to 12 people, mostly girls, but some boys as well. And it meets at a very important place. It's a women's shelter, right?
Yes.
And so once a week, you and your friends go and to this women's shelter to talk about feminist issues. You've talked about the suffragettes. You've talked about dress codes and this distraction idea. You gave speeches in the name of different feminists. You've talked about Gloria and Suzanne. Is that right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So they have questions that they've talked about with their friends and that they have in their own. And I think Faith has the first question.
Do you think our lives as 11-year-olds are different from your lives when you were 11?
Absolutely. There's no question. I can't imagine being able to organize as quickly as you have, to open up the conversation as thoughtfully as you have. You are so far ahead of us. And that's what's exciting, because even though we've had these setbacks, it's so clear that you and other young women are going to take us forward, that as tired and despairing as we sometimes feel, the notion that you are sitting with 6 or 8 other feminists in a women's shelter, where I assume the women also participate, is so encouraging, because you'll figure it out. You'll figure out what to do next.
Do the two of you regard yourselves as optimistic? Do you think that, and I'm asking Adina and Faith this, but actually I should ask Gloria and Suzanne, everyone. Here's a question I'll start with Adina and Faith. Are you optimistic about the future? Do you think that the changes that you want to make are doable in your lifetime?
Yes and no.
Okay, yes and no?
Well, some of them, of us sharing it with kids in our class, in our school, is changing it for the better. But no, is not everybody listens.
Suzanne, Gloria, are you optimistic after all of this time, or is your frustration with the backlash, does it cloud your hope?
You have to be optimistic. If you believe that social justice is where we should be and where everybody will be better off, it, as discouraging as this is, and I have to say this is the most discouraging time in my lifetime, I do believe that, as Gloria always says, the strength of the backlash is reflective of the strength of the movement. And I think we'll get through this. And as I said before, I think that young women like you who are going to come up with new ways of dealing with all of these forces are going to make all the difference. I think it's all yours now.
You really are way, way, way ahead in terms of your own lives and where you are now compared to where Suzanne and I were at 11. But I do think it's important to be optimistic because hope is a form of planning. You know, if our hopes weren't already inside us, we couldn't even hope them. So they have a reality. It's also important to be skeptical. So I liked your yes and no answer. I think that's important because we don't want to waste our energies. And I think it's important to understand how deep the changes are that we are seeking. I was naive in the beginning, and I thought, oh, this is so unjust. Certainly if I just explain it to people, they will want to change it. And I didn't realize that unequal pay was causing billions of dollars in profit and that controlling women's bodies was necessary to the whole idea of population and keeping races separate. And so, you know, I just didn't understand the depth of the change that we were asking for. And because I didn't, I think I burned out a couple of times because I was just flat-out activist without pacing myself, without understanding that this was not going to be just a few years, but this was going to be my lifetime and lifetimes beyond that.
Were there things when you were 11 that you wanted to change, but you couldn't or weren't allowed to?
Well, as I said before, being a tomboy, certainly the notion, I mean, for me, it came down to my flannel-lined jeans and the matching flannel shirt that I wanted to wear every day, and the negative reaction I got to that, not from necessarily my friends, but from the adults in my life. I would have liked, I was not an activist in my, when I was 11, and I'm sorry about that, because I had a lot of opportunities and I might have become an activist sooner. I was in a very safe place, and the ideas of the education I had were very egalitarian, and if I were 11 now in that circumstance, I know I would be more activist. But it, for me, it came down to sports and clothing.
Faith, you had a similar experience, right, with sports that was really meaningful to you.
Yes. When I was in fourth grade, I wanted to play a game, and some boys wouldn't let me because I was a girl. That made me really upset.
So is this still in school? Is there still really this idea that boys and girls have to play separately and that there are boys' games and girls' games?
Yeah.
Do boys and girls listen when you say that this is a false division, or is everyone sort of just already established in their mind?
Sometimes. I mean, it's pretty rare that we actually change somebody's mind about this. There are certain times when certain people, there are two boys who come to our feminist group regularly, and they're, I think, the only ones who actually, well, they're not the only ones, but they're one of the ones that their minds are more open to the idea that everything doesn't have to be separate, that sports are for boys. And
I think, Adina, you had a question about changing people's minds, right?
That was Faith.
Faith, you had a question about changing people's minds. Why don't you ask that question now?
When we had posters for our group at school, people stole or graffitied them. How do you deal with people who don't believe the same thing you do?
Well, it's they're free not to believe the same things, but they're not free to steal your posters and put graffiti on your posters. So that is stealing and defacing somebody else's property. So they need to learn. I hope the teachers or somebody told them they can't do that. That's just not fair. I think, you know, the two things that we grow up saying, it's not fair and you are not the boss of me, are pretty good guides to every social justice movement. If you just hang on to them, you'll be okay.
The principal was actually wonderful about it. The principal, Adina and Faith, not surprisingly, went to the principal to complain because they were very upset. And the principal responded by saying the school was going to pay all the replacement costs for the posters.
Yeah, now we can use their color printers and they're giving us paper.
That's great. But what happened to the kids, or did you find the kids who defaced or stole the posters?
We didn't find them. Really, the only thing we could do was we keep a stack in our backpack, and when we see one is missing, we just put in another one right back up, because there's no really way to tell who took them unless we actually see the person who's doing it.
I see. Well, you know, I'm glad that some effort was made to figure it out, because I bet if somebody stole something that belonged to a teacher, they would figure it out, you know.
But I admire your perseverance. That's half the battle, if you just keep coming back and not accepting that you've lost, or that you've come up against a force that's bigger than you are. The idea that you're coming back and putting the posters up, they're going to get tired of tearing them down, and your message is going to be out there, and other people are going to pay attention. So perseverance is half the game.
In my mind, at least, perseverance is connected to Wonder Woman. And I say that both because both Faith and Adina are real big fans of comic books and superheroes.
Yeah.
And the first issue of Ms. Magazine, if I recall correctly, had Wonder Woman on the cover. And Gloria, you wrote an essay on Wonder Woman. Could you talk a little bit to the girls about the importance of these kinds of role models and what Wonder Woman meant to you?
When I was growing up, Wonder Woman was pretty much the only female hero in the comic book world. Actually, she had been invented by a psychologist for that very purpose, because he was alarmed by the comics of World War II that were full of violence and torture and war images. In fact, so much so that they inspired a congressional hearing against them. And he invented Wonder Woman to be someone who won by persuasion and by a magic lasso that meant you had to tell the truth, and all kinds of means that had to do with ingenuity and strength and speed, but did not have to do with killing anybody. Wonder Woman then, in the 1950s, fell into disrepair, as women did in general in the conservative 1950s, and became kind of a car hop. So we at Ms. Magazine decided that we would try to restore her to her original self and her original powers by running some of her early Golden Age Wonder Woman comic strips in the magazine and putting her on the cover. So we did that, and we conducted a campaign, and I remember getting a telephone call from the person at DC Comics who was then in charge of creating Wonder Woman, saying, okay, all right, she has her magical powers back. She has her magic bracelets back. She has an African-American sister named Nubia, Amazon named Nubia. Now will you leave me alone? So I'm so glad that Wonder Woman is back and that she's with you, and I know she's happy too.
I was thinking about the word Ms. and its importance. Do you think that for transgender people who are boys who are girls and girls who are boys, a word like Ms. would help them with their identity, since the word Ms. helped women with their identities so much?
Yes, I think it's, well, it's up to the individual, isn't it? I think if someone was born a boy and becomes a girl, then Ms. might have a lot of importance. I do think that gendered forms of address like Mr., Mrs., or Ms. are falling out of use because it's less important. We're more likely to identify as humans. But if gender has an importance in our lives, then those are there to be helpful.
But there's really no need for Mr., Ms., Mrs., or even coming up with a new one. It's, in a way, it categorizes people. You are who you are, and there you are. You don't need to be identified. I hope that all of those designations fall by the wayside.
Was there something in your life that made you realize you had to become a feminist?
Well, I guess it would be being born female. being born into a particular role and realizing that that was a narrow role, and that also people born male were getting restricted too from being fully human and having all the human qualities. There have been a lot of words for feminism. You know, we started out saying women's liberation, and some people say womanist instead of feminist because it sounds stronger. Alice Walker prefers womanist. Feminist is not the only word. I like girls with two or three R's, too. Do you ever use that? I think that looks kind of great. But right now, the belief that we're all human is still in a stage of needing remedial effort. So feminism is a remedial effort. But once we get to wholeness, we won't need those words.
We are running out of time. And I know that you had a bunch of different questions, but there is one more question that I think is really important that they want to ask before we all have to go our separate ways.
How do we tell girls about feminism and feminist issues without making them afraid to be a girl?
You know, I think the first step is to listen to that girl. And you'll hear something probably that is troubling her. You know, maybe she gets less of an allowance than her brother, or maybe she feels that she has to wear a skirt in school if there's a school uniform. Or I don't know. There's some unfairness in her life that you hear. And you can say, well, here's the unfairness I feel in my life, too, and here's what I'm doing about it. And if we do it together, we'll be much more likely to succeed. And that's feminism.
Thank you. That was a good answer.
So, Adina, Faith, thank you so much for writing the questions, thinking about them, being brave enough to come speak for your group. Thank you for joining us on Why.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And thank you for your voices. I can't tell you, I think just hearing you two reawakens the girl in us. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And Suzanne, Gloria, before I go off mic and weep with pride from these two wonderful people, I want to thank both of you for taking the time. It's an incredibly busy time for both of you. The march, the election, all the post-game analysis. And I've learned a tremendous amount from both of you in my life. I've learned a tremendous amount of both of you on this show. And I just can't think of, again, as I started the show by saying, I can't think of two people who would be more appropriate to celebrate this milestone with us. So thank you so much for joining us on Wyand. Thank you so much for pushing us and helping us to think deeply about all these issues for so long, and particularly today.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for making a circle, even though we're far away.
You've been listening to Jack Russell Weinstein, Gloria Steinem, Suzanne Braun-Levine, and Adina and Faith on Y Radio, and we'll be back right after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Y Radio store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org.
You're back with Jack Russell Weinstein on Y Radio. We've been talking about feminism, politics, friendship, and of course, philosophy, as we always do. It's such a difficult task to talk philosophically about something that you just take for granted, about something that's always with you. I have been incredibly lucky to grow up in a feminist household, to be surrounded by feminist women, and to have a job in which I can read feminist texts. And yet at the same time, there are things that I learn every day, and there are things that as a man and just as a human being, I am completely oblivious to. And the constant reminder that I have to think carefully about the issue of gender and the issue of how we relate to one another is both a blessing and a curse, right? It's a blessing because it allows me to engage. It's a blessing because it allows me to think critically and learn new things. But it's a curse because it reminds me that there are still so many places to go, and there are so many people who are not regarded as full human beings. Gloria and Suzanne took us on a journey today. They took us on a journey from the earliest days of Ms. Magazine to right now, in the election, post-election, when the movement, as Suzanne said, is bigger than any march she had ever seen, and yet she feels more despondent and frustrated than she's ever been. This is a profound mixture, but it's an important mixture because it shows us that with every push comes a pushback, which with every backlash comes a reassertion of rights, of equality, of the demand for true personhood on the part of women and on the part of everyone. The task of this show is to take that and put it into an intellectual frame, not just to promote the activism, but to promote the philosophy behind it, to promote the thoughts and to help us refine so that we know what questions to ask and how to pursue those answers. This was our 100th episode. I am incredibly grateful for the opportunity to be here with all of you. Over the last 8 years, I have got to meet the most amazing people, and I've got to ask the most amazing questions. But it's the listeners, ultimately, that are the most exciting, because at this microphone, I have to advocate for them, much the same way that Gloria and Suzanne advocate for women and for all of humanity. I hope we have another 100 episodes. I hope we have another 8 years. And I hope that we get to talk to Suzanne, to Gloria, and to everyone who's had such a profound effect politically and philosophically on our world. And I hope that you continue to stay with us as we do it all. You've been listening to Jack Russell Weinstein and Y Radio, and as always, it's an honor to be with you.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album, Lua y Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/Mark Weinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower.